Hey guys, just a quick heads up. Dr. O'Shea has several books in publication right now, so feel free to go around, find them on Amazon, most likely, and go and give them a good read. Sure you'll enjoy them. Thanks.
Hello everyone, I'm Nate Truex, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello everyone, welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host Nate, and today I'm joined by Dr. Mark O'Shea of the University of Wolverhampton, who is also a member of the IUCN Monitor, Skink, and Snakes Survival Specialist Groups. A very prominent researcher when it comes to snake venom and snake bite research, and also a very famous animal show host. Mark, well, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Nate. Nice to be here.
So you want to get us started with how you first got into reptiles and how you became such an accomplished researcher?
Oh, right. Well, I got into reptiles. I was interested in reptiles when I was very young. And I think one of the things was the fact that nobody else seemed to like them. And, you know, I remember I was the sort of boy in the playground who would ask the girls if they liked the Beatles. And then if they said yes, I'd give them a matchbox with a Beatle in it. I don't know if it was John Paul Ringo, you know. But yeah, I was animal orientated. I was animal orientated, and I really liked snakes. And I met my first snake when I was young at Dublin Zoo, ironically, in Ireland. A boa constrictor that was twice as long as I was tall, but that was in the zoo. And then I saw my first snake a couple of years later, maybe. On a beauty spot near where I live, a place called Kinveredge that straddles the Staffordshire-Worcestershire border. To you guys, that's Worcestershire, but that's not how we pronounce it. There's adders on there, Viperberus, and I saw my first adder and fortunately failed to catch it because small boys and venomous snakes are a very poor combination. But I took it from there, and before long I'd got an Italian grass snake as a pet, and I started increasing my collection. And by my 20s, I'd probably got around 200 snakes. I was breeding snakes, you know, 70s and 80s. I had a quite large collection, and I started getting involved. Well, I did a degree as a mature student because I'd been working in what you'd call, I think, a trauma room. I'd been working in an action emergency department. So I'd left school. I'd walked out. I'd just left, dropped out. And I got a job working in the National Health Service. And I did that for about 7 years. But I pined to get back into education and to improve my possibilities. And so I managed to talk myself into a polytechnic, which later became a university, to do a degree, and that's where I'm now a professor. So I've gone full circle. I graduated from there in 1985, and that was a year later than I should have done because I'd taken a sabbatical to organize an expedition into the heart of Borneo in 1983 into 1984. And so I did that. And when I was organizing that expedition, 7-man expedition, I came into contact with some people who were setting up something called Operation Raleigh, which was taking youngsters around the world for 3 to 4 months on basically adventure, but adventure, science, and community work. And they asked me to get involved in that, so I did. And so I did 3 expeditions for them. Honduras in Central America in 1985, Papua New Guinea in 1986, and Cameroon in 1989. And in between, I was in the Amazon for the Royal Geographical Society, who needed a herpetologist on a field station there for a long time. So that's how I got into expeditions. And I needed a job when I came back. And by pure luck, the safari park not far from me was planning a reptile house. And they asked me if I'd get involved and help design it and determine what would go in the exhibits and so forth, and then set up the exhibits And that was in the winter of 86. And I said, for sure. Then in 1987, they asked me at the beginning of 87, would I run it? And I said, well, I will. I will. On two conditions. One, you pay me for 5 days, but I only want work four, because I was doing other stuff as well. I was writing and things. And two, I want the freedom to go overseas whenever I want to do field work. And you keep my job open for when I come back. And they agreed to both, which was surprising, because it does seem to weigh in my favor. But in the end, with me ending up in television as well, it proved that it actually was a very symbiotic relationship. And within a couple of months of starting, the Royal Geographical Society asked me to go to Brazil. So I was gone for the rest of the year. And the Safari Park were great. And so I moved my collection in there because I didn't want to clean out snakes all day and then go home and do it at home. And I moved my collection in, and that was half of the collection in the early days, and took it from there. So where from there? And I started doing work for television companies. I first appeared front of camera in 1987 when I was in Brazil on a show called Odyssey. And I started working, doing a lot of wrangling in studios for Naturalist, Blue Chip Naturalist, BBC, Naturalist Unit, all the indies, Tigris, Partridge, all these big independent naturalist filmmakers. And then I fell backwards into actually presenting. And I did Giant Snake in 1996 in Venezuela, Black Mamba in 97 in South Africa. And then in 1999, I was offered my own series, which started out as 6 half-hours. While we were filming it, they liked it so much, it became 13 half-hours. That was the first season of O'Shea's Big Adventure. Then there was a second season of O'Shea's Big Adventure, 13 half-hours. Then there was two seasons of one-hour specials, 4 in each. And that's where it was into TV. And then I went on to do some more TV after that with other companies. But I like academia, and I left the Safari Park in 2019. I'd had a really good relationship with them. It was very reciprocal. I never worked a full year. I've never worked a full year for anybody. Because in 20, I'd started doing some visiting lecturing at my old alma mater, the University of Wolverhampton, which was the Polytechnic of Wolverhampton, which had given me my opportunity to become a scientist, out of a snake enthusiast. And I was doing some visiting lecturing there, and they asked me if, on my way back from doing some lectures and some museum work in Australia, I'd stop by Sri Lanka. Because they were doing a joint thing with a college in Sri Lanka, the graduations for the degrees and everything. And they asked me if I'd come and do a presentation. So I said I would. And then after that, being in Sri Lanka, during filming, I'd opened the herpetarium at the University of Colombo, where they kept venomous snakes for snake bite research. Now, that was 21 years earlier. But I thought, oh, I wonder how it's doing. So I phoned up and I said, oh, could I pop over? And they said, for sure. And I said, could I bring 4 colleagues? And they said, yeah, bring them along. So I took 4 of the professors from Wolverhampton to see venomous snakes. And they thought they were going to see venomous snakes in cages and look at them. Well, I got them into the room. And then I started taking out venomous snakes and putting them on the floor in front of them, between them and the door, incidentally, so they couldn't run. Only one at a time, but I'd get a cobra up nice and hooding. I'd put a Russell's Viper down and it'd make a lot of noise, you know, things like this. And they were well impressed, I think, because when I got back to the university, I was asked if I would be interested in a professorship. And I said, yeah, absolutely, because I could do my research. And it took 18 months for the professorship to go through, because there's a lot involved. You've got to do interviews. You've got to prove that you're worthy of that. And in 2018, I became professor of herpetology at the University of Wolverhampton. And in 2019, I parted company with the Safari Park. So now I'm at the university. I still go to the Safari Park twice a year. I take my students, and I also go to do a lecture for tropical medicine doctors from the Warwick Medical School, which is one of our best medical schools in the UK. And I do, they have a day at the Safari Park, and I do a lecture on venomous snake identification and which species are responsible globally, da-di-da-di-da. So I'm still dropping in to the place I spent 33 years working. So that's it in a nutshell. And I've probably left a great deal out. I've left a lot of expeditions out. I've left the books out. I've left, yeah, but draw a box around that.
That's quite a lot of accomplishments. I also want to touch on the books, because actually that's how I first heard about you, was through your books, specifically Boas and Pythons of the World.
Oh, trying to find my copy. 2007, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to find my copy of it, but I can't find it. Couldn't find it before the podcast, but that's actually what got me into Australian pythons. So I actually got my first snake. I decided what type of snake would be my first snake based on that book. So
did you know? Okay, right. Which was
Arian Jaya carpet python.
Okay, well, we'll ditch the Arian Jaya, shall we? Because it hasn't been called that for nigh on 30 years.
Papuan then?
Papuan. You see, it'd take a long time to explain this, but like the Indonesians have Papua. And they now divide it into Papua Province, Highland Papua, South Papua, Central Papua, West Papua, Southwest Papua, which is oddly in the northwest, go figure. And then, of course, if you cross the border, you've got the independent sovereign state of Papua New Guinea. And people have a real problem working out. New Guinea is the island.
Yeah.
And the carpet you've got, it will have been from the Merauke region, which is where they come in over the border from Western Province, Papua New Guinea. I mean, I've caught quite a few of those. Yeah. So I'd be inclined to refer to that as a transfly, because it's the transfly region, that big river. It's the biggest of the three. Well, is it the biggest? Is it bigger? The Sepik? Sepik might be bigger. But a fly river is one of the three big rivers, the other being the Mambaramo. And that's sort of like in its big water flood basin down in the south. And although there's an international border down the middle, vertically, Merauke is similar to the Western Province on the other side of the border, except for the fact that Merauke is very heavily populated because they've translocated a lot of Indonesians there, and there's a lot of rice farming. Paddy fields and like, whereas if you go over the border, you won't see any of that. It's really sparsely populated, and if all the settlements are on the rivers or on Daru Island, so it's much more as it was before it got populated. But yeah, that's I know where you're talking about. Yes, so that they'd be a bit bitey, those can certainly, the ones from Central Province are. I've caught loads of those and relocated them out of town. I used to drive out on wet nights and just pick them off the road before people run them over. And then I drive up to a place called Sapphire Mine on the way to Sigiri. And this mine was reputedly owned at one time by Errol Flynn, because he was in New Guinea in the 30s. But that's the rumor, but I don't know. But I've been up there and I've caught a lot of carpets in the mine workings. So I used to think, right, okay, any I catch in town, I'll take out of town, and I'll put them up there. They're out of the way of people deliberately running them over. But sadly, they've now taken the mine away, salvaged it for scrap, which is a great shame, because I used to love going up there. It was prime Papuan Taipan country as well.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, but those Morelia Spilota, I believe it's Variegata is the subspecies name. I'm trying to remember the exact subspecies name.
There isn't really one. You know, the name Harrison I was thrown up by somebody who's not a taxonomist. I'm saying no more about that. But nobody, you see, there was a time with the carpet pythons, really, when Spilota Spilota was the diamond python and everything else pretty much was Variegata. And so the New Guinea population got called Variegata, obviously. But what is now Variegata doesn't occur that close to New Guinea. You've got McDowley, McCarthy and things like that, I think, in the Cape York Peninsula that points up towards New Guinea. And whether they are that species, I don't know. I really wish one of the molecular jockeys would actually resolve it. And I think that there could end up being two subspecies potentially because of the reproductive isolation. The Meroki population across the border into Western Province. Yeah, that's quite a large area. But then if you follow, if you keep going eastwards, you start it in Gulf Province, which is a lot of mangrove swamps and bisected by rivers. And they haven't got the same degree of, there's not much savanna. There are pockets of savanna, but not much. And then you get round and onto the other side of the Gulf of Papua, and you come down the central province, the southern versant of the Owen Stanley Range, through Port Moresby and all the way down. And there's loads of them there, but they've been isolated for quite a long time from the Western Province population. So I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. And I'm sure some of the molecular guys are looking at that, because it sort of sticks up like a sore thumb. What is it? But just adopting Harrison I, no. I don't think so. Not unless it's proven.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll just call them fly river pythons for now, but
Transfly. Transfly. Transfly would be probably fairer, because the fly river does come, and it actually loops into Indonesia and New Guinea. If you look at the border, it's pushed to the border's pushed across because of the fly river arching in, and the border goes round it. So yeah, and that's a pretty contiguous sort of habitat all the way up there. It's flooded for a large part of the year, and then it's dry and you can walk. But in western province, the main means of getting about anywhere, although there are a couple of grass roads and there are the occasional vehicles, but very few, the main way is by boat, you know, the river. And they're all crocodile rivers as well.
Yeah, I'm guessing primarily salties with the occasional Nova Guinea.
Let me
rephrase that. Nova Guinea in the upper reaches and Perosis in the lower delta.
Yeah, I would say that to be fair. But don't forget that Horlite is also a New Guinea croc now. And that's the molecular data.
I can't remember which one's the northern, which one's the southern.
I think the northern one's Hawley. That's because, they morphologically, they look similar, but the populations are isolated. The central highlands, which are isolated, and other mountain ranges. And I think when somebody looks at the American croc, they're going to find up to five species hiding in there, because the Jamaican population is supposed to be unique. The South Floridian Cubans probably the same. You've got them running along Venezuela and Colombian coast and up into the Gulf. And then you've got that Pacific population on the other side. So, you know, there's something going on there. And ultimately, I mean, when I was a child, there were 23 species of crocodilians, and there were 23 species up until into this century, and suddenly now we've got 27, and that's because of the of DNA being able to determine and distinguish morphologically very similar animals from different isolated locations. So it's a marvelous tool.
It really is, yeah. Yeah, but I was going to say about the TransFly carpets I have. I have three of them right now. You're actually the laptop I'm recording this on top of the one of the cages I keep one in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The first one I ever kept is just off that side, and the second one I have is just a little bit down to the left, so.
What size are they?
My adult male, I got him back in 2018. They said he was about 2 years old at the time, so he's probably about,
you can go
probably
feet.
Maybe about seven years old.
Yeah, you can go feet. We still understand those across here.
I'd probably say about 3.5 to 4 foot, so.
Yeah, I've seen bigger specimens in Western Province than I've seen in Central Province around Moresby. And most of the pythons I've seen there have been a lot smaller, but that could be simply down to human pressure. Around the capital, they never grow up. They get slaughtered. You know, I mean, yeah. a wet night, you could go out and you could find half a dozen easily, but a lot of them would already be roadkill.
Yeah, I remember reading in your book how someone tried to mug you while you had a.
Yes. Well, I knew what he was about, and I just knew what he was going to work. Shall I tell the story?
Go ahead.
Well, I was coming back to where I was staying from. I'd been working. I can't remember if I was up at the museum or the university, but I'd been working quite late on specimens, and I caught a PMV, which is like a minibus, back into the center of Port Moresby. And I'd got to then walk to where I was staying with friends. And I'd got a sack with this carpet python in. And I can't remember if I'd picked it up on the way or if I was taking it back for some reason. But anyway, I'd got a bag with a carpet python in. And I'm walking down this road past the hospital, and it's pretty deserted and it's dark. And this guy came along, and he's suddenly my best friend, you know, walking with me. What's your name? Where are you from? All the bog standard, I'm going to get your confidence, and you're going to think I'm a nice guy sort of question. So I just answered him because I knew what was coming. And after a while, when he'd exhausted his repertoire of pointless questions, he asked me, what's in the bag? Because I'm sure that's what had attracted his attention in the first place. So I said, well, you tell me. I'll give you three guesses, and if you get it right, you can have it. And so he guessed the sort of things you give away to complete strangers, like a camera. I can't even remember, you know, stupid camera, money, you know, a gold bar.
Yeah.
It didn't look that heavy, but just utterly ludicrous things he guessed for the three things he hoped I'd got. So I said, no, that's a shame. All wrong. But you were close. Would you like a look? And I opened the bag and he looked in and he saw this carpet python looking back up at him and he recoiled like he'd been shot. And you know something? With all this conversation walking along the road, we must have gone past his turning. Because it was 50 yards back down the road, and he obviously had somewhere to be because he was gone. I was looking forward to him asking, and I got this all ready for him and just fed it him. It was, and the reaction was exactly what I expected. Yeah, that was fun.
Carpet pythons, the ultimate anti-mugging device.
Well, funnily enough, I was working in New Guinea one time when there was a lot of crime and there were curfews, and you weren't allowed out at night on the roads without a very good reason. But fortunately, I knew some of the police who were on the checkpoints, and I knew this elderly gnarled sergeant whose blue uniform had been washed so many times, it was sky blue. And he was always there with the pump action, and he was in charge. And quite often when I drove back into town after the curfew had come in, he'd slow me down and, oh, yes, yes, no problem, no problem. And he'd say, what have you caught? And if I showed him, I'd say, well, I caught a scrub python or so. And I'd be there longer showing them the snakes I'd caught than I would be if they were searching the car. But I had freedom to you know, they all knew who I was and what I was doing. And I used to drive around with a snake box. We called them snake Pullmans back in the day. It was a box with a hole in the side and a trapdoor, and you fed the snake in. It's in case I got something venomous on the road. And I used to sometimes find venomous stuff, micropeckies, not around Moresby, but on the northern coast. And you feed it into there. And then if you need to, you can take it out the top. You know, so we called them snake Pullmans. And good Pullman's a sleeping car on the train. So it was, and on this box, it said, Tok Savvy Tambu, Dispel a Bocky, Semi Got Snake, Savvy Killing You, which is Pidgin English. And I think you can work out what it was. Don't open this box, you might die. So that was just on the back seat of the car. And I might have nothing in it, but it took a very brave mugger to find out. But the other thing that I used to do to deter people from trying to rob me was I would keep a shed snake skin wrapped around the rearview mirror. And people would come up to the door and they'd see it and they'd literally recoil. Because, you know, they just... And one of the most serious things I had happen was I was in the Mekio region, which is quite a dangerous area. There are villages there that basically their stock in trade is highwaymen. And I drove up there one night with a Papua New Guinean from the museum, and we were trying to find a mission hospital where I was going to be doing some work looking for Papuan black snakes and death adders. And we got lost. And I pulled into near this village and I said, you go and find guard directions and I'll sit here. And I'm driving a little red car that I was loaned by the Mother Superior of a convent in Port Moresby. And she said, do look after my car, won't you, young man? So I was duty bound to look after her car. Anyway, I'm sat there in the driving seat and they drive on the same side as we do. The steering wheel is on the right side, right? Not the wrong side. So I'm sitting there on the right-hand side of the steering wheel and my colleagues left the door open and it's dark and I'm just sat there waiting for him to return. And I heard him get in and sit down and the door shut. And I looked across and it wasn't him. It was a young guy with a bush knife, a machete. And he prodded me in the side with a machete. And he said, we go now. So I moved slightly to the side, more to face him a little, and said, no. And in so doing, I put my hand on my dashboard and I had a bar towel there, and under the bar towel was my machete, my bush knife. And you know, it was just there hidden, but for security. And I thought, if you stab me, I'm going to stab you. And I just have to bring my hand round, but I don't want to. So I'm going to try and brazen this out. But knowing I'd got that, I said to him, that's Timothy's seat. Get the F out of my car. And he's obviously got the idiot guide to carjacking, where it says, if you poke somebody with a large bush knife or a machete, they will go, where do you want me to take you? Well, I wasn't having that.
Yeah.
The Mother Superior's car. He's not taking it anywhere. So I told him, and I told him twice. And he sat there for a moment in silence, thinking this through. And then he got out, closed the door, smiled, and walked off. So I think his carjacking career ended very early. But, yeah, I didn't lose the car.
So. You kept your honor, so.
Ah, yeah, kept me honor. Kept me honor. Yeah.
So, working in New Guinea, did you ever do any work with Bolan's pythons?
I was given a Bolan's once that was brought down. somebody brought it down on the plane as baggage and delivered it to me at the museum. And I had that Bolens for a couple of hours, but I gave it to the museum because they've got a, they had a live collection there, a nice live collection. They had Bolens. And I gave them this one because, you see, the Bolens python in Papua New Guinea is totally protected. Unless you're a national, you can't possess it or any aspect of it. So really, a piece of shed skin would be crossing the line. So I relished having this snake for a couple of hours before I handed it over to the live collection. But I also, with my friend David Williams, who was out there a very long time working, he's now works for the WHO, World Health Organization in Geneva, on the big snake bite projects that are coming to the fore now. But he worked on snake bite, and I worked with him for quite some time in New Guinea. And we were occasionally asked to go and do sort of field surveys and we were asked to go up to, there was LNG, liquid natural gas set up in the in the Southern Highlands, and it had been suggested that what they were doing was injurious to the Bolens python. And they'd already had a guy from the WWF say, no, you're fine. The pythons don't come down this low. But when we went up there, we got the elevations that they were basically taking the tops off hills. We said, no, this is prime Bolens python habitat. And if you're doing this, you are potentially causing a problem, which meant suddenly our use of helicopters and our driver disappeared and all sorts of things because we hadn't said what they wanted us to say. I won't name the company, but they wanted us to sign off on something that we couldn't sign off on. But I haven't caught Bolens myself. I've been in the absolute habitats. And unfortunately, I know that in some of these areas, they catch and eat them. Even though some of the Papuan tribal groups treat the python as sacred, Bolens pythons do get killed and eaten, which is a very expensive meal if you think about it.
Yeah, think of what they go for in the U.S. market. So yeah, it's a $10,000 meal.
But equally, you know, I mean, it's a species of people who've been trying to breed for a long time. I wish they were available as captive bred because, you know, there's any snake or any animal which is like a top species that people want that isn't being bred in captivity, then the wild populations can't sustain it. And
yeah,
whether the snake is the snakes are collected by traders and sold overseas or run over on the roads or killed and eaten by people working for forestry companies or whatever, they're disappearing from the population, and the population could plummet. And I don't think that they're certainly not as dense on the ground as things like carpets or even amethystine scrub pythons, which you can find quite easily. They're not the only one you don't see often. The Apodura papuana. I mean, I've been to Papua New Guinea, 10 times? I've seen, 12? If you see one on a trip, that's something. They're a big python that you just don't encounter all that often. Nothing like you find, I mean, in the south, it's carpet pythons and amethystine scrub pythons. In the north, it's D'Alberts and amethystines that you encounter. But I used to drive a road in Madang province on the north coast when I was out there in the 1990s. And I could drive that road and I would find amethystine pythons, D'Albertis pythons, green tree pythons crossing the road. They then tarmacked it. I mean, the road to drive from Madang to Bogia, it would take several hours. Now you can drive it. It's a proper blacktop road. And you drive that road now, you won't see snakes, because all the snakes that lived along it have been killed. You know, it's a desert.
Yeah.
Because once you put a road in like that, you'll get shops and houses, and gradually it'll be like an artery. And any snakes that don't get killed crossing roads will be caught in the gardens just off from the roads and dragged onto the roads because people noose them, drag them onto the road and hold them there and wait for cars to run over them and things like that. So if you end up finding on the roads at night, you find Boygia regularis and whichever species of Steganotus is in the area. And that's often it. And I remember from the 90s, and I remember in 1986 going out on the road in the south, and I was catching lots of snakes. Not now. And I've seen that in my lifetime. And I'm sure if you looked back at Carl Caulfield's records for night cruising, in Arizona and New Mexico, yes, you still do see a lot of buzz tails. 3 out of 4 snakes is a buzz tail if you go and drive some of those roads. But I bet if people had kept records, and somebody may have done, of the number of snakes, live and dead, seen over a period of time, the numbers are down.
Yeah, it won't surprise me.
More traffic. And so we have to be aware of this.
Yeah. So speaking of Papua New Guinea, that's where the majority of the species you helped describe were from, right?
I've described
species, or at least some of them.
Papua New Guinea, I've done West New Guinea, which you want to call Papua, that's fine. Timor-Leste, Java, Borneo, Myanmar. But most of my work, I wrote the Field Guide to the Snakes of New Guinea in 1996. It's massively out of date. You can actually download a PDF of it from ResearchGate and academia.edu. I put it up there for people to download for free.
But I'm working. I can do that after this, though.
Yeah, but remember, it is massively out of date. Massively. Like, there were 8 species in the genus Toxica calamus that I work on. It's an Elapi genus. There are 8 species. There were 8 species from when Boger described a subspecies in 1945. And then let's see, Sam McDowell described some species in 1967 and 69. And then that was it. We've got 9 taxa, 8 species and a subspecies. But Fred Krause started working on them in 2008, or 2009, I was working on them at the same time. There are now 25 species in that one genus. And I'm working on another 3 or 4, possibly more when we get the data back. Because New Guinea wasn't as well known as Borneo. You do get new species, but not as frequently, because Borneo has been explored and researched for so much longer than New Guinea. In fact, the early expeditions in New Guinea in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, quite a lot of them, especially those in West New Guinea, Indonesian New Guinea, it was Dutch then, they brought in ibans and dayaks from Borneo to basically work on the projects, and to do a lot of the work, the cutting of trails and the handling of boats, because Borneo was sort of so tamed by then, but New Guinea wasn't, and there was still a lot of internectine warfare going on between tribes and so forth. So New Guinea's some way behind Borneo in exploration, but it's beginning to catch up. And I'm working on the revision of the New Guinea snakes, and there's going to be a lot more species. For a start, there's Antaresia in New Guinea, isn't there? Wasn't, when I wrote the book, Antaresia was only, it's endemic to Australia. And then when I was filming with Rob Spracklund in Western Province, I found a little snake, which really puzzled me to start with, because I'm going, it's a python, but which one is it? Because it's not any of the ones. I would go, it's a baby scrub. No, it's not. It's a water python. No, it's not. So I had to sit down and go back to first principles. Okay, to Python, work from there. And I realized it was Antaresia. And I gave the specimen to a colleague from the museum, and they kept it alive. And when it died, it got preserved as a specimen. And I wrote it up with Rob Spratland a few years later. And well, no, a couple of years later at most, from when I was filming, as a range extension for Maculosa. Because although I felt it could be different enough to be a new species, otherwise I didn't have enough evidence. And it wasn't until it's now being described as Papuensis, and there's been other specimens found. And they're now determining whether it comes into Queensland as well. So Antaresia should have gone up to five species, but it didn't, because Stimson eye was sunk into the synonymy of children eye. So everyone who's got Stimson pythons, no, you haven't. So, I mean, that's the kind of surprise that you sometimes have. You go, wow, what's that doing here? And I had that in East Timor when one of the girls on the expedition shouted me, Mark, there's a snake. And I jumped over a log and I saw this snake go underneath and I grabbed it. A stegi, what are you doing here? I knew it as a Steganotus, which is a genus I'm very familiar with from New Guinea, but they're not recorded from Timor. But I knew it was a Steganotus. And we eventually collected five specimens, and that became Steganotus nankuru about 15 to 18 months later when all the work's been done and published. So, yeah, you sometimes find things you don't expect. And I'm pretty sure that almost anybody, well, a lot of herpers go and they go herping in tropical countries, and they will have seen new species. They might not have been new lizards or snakes. They might have been spiders or moths. Because to recognize something as a new species, you have to have a good handle on what has already been described, which means you have to be a little bit of an expert on that group. And I'm pretty sure I've encountered undescribed species of spiders and moths and things like that, maybe even frogs, because although I do some work on frogs, I wouldn't call myself a frog expert. Yes, I've just written a book on frogs, yes, but snakes are my primary thing. But there are people more expert on frogs than me, and so I might have thought, oh well, that's a so-and-so, and it turns out that it's not later on. And certainly I've sent photos to backtrackologists, as frog people should probably be called. And they go, well, did you collect that? I said, no, I just photographed it. Well, that's not what you think it is. And that's been the case with, like, in Litoria infrafrenata, the big white-lipped tree frog, massive thing. And I photographed one on the northern cape of Milne Bay that was all speckled. And I let it go. It's a new species. Okay, well, I now know that. And if I encounter another one, I'm afraid it will get vouchered. And it'll get described.
All right. So you also do some work with, sounds like a lot of work with snake bite research and setting up labs around the world with that.
I'm not setting up labs around the world. I've been involved with snake bite research quite a long time. I've done some work in Sri Lanka, and I made a film about that when I was there with Professor David Worrell, or as he now should be, Professor Sir David Worrell, KCMG. I've done a lot of work in Papua New Guinea. I started working on snake bite there in 1990 with Oxford University and the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. And then this century, I continued that with David Williams from the University of Melbourne, the Australian Venom Research Unit. And they gave me a fellowship to carry on working with them. We caught all the snakes we caught, we kept in New Guinea in a building on the hospital campus, which is probably the safest building in New Guinea because it had about 20 taipans in it. And most people aren't going to break in there. We were catching a lot of taipans. I mean, we went to one location, which I will not name, and in a week we saw 46 Papuan taipans and managed to catch 10 of them because they are ballast. I had one latch into the top of my boot, just below the skin. So they are pretty fast. But yeah, we were involved in producing an anti-venom with we would milk the snakes and send the dried venom to Costa Rica to the real heroes of snake bite research, the Instituto Clodomiro Picado in the University of San Jose, Costa Rica. Those guys are the heroes of snake bite research. They produce anti-venoms for Costa Rica. They produce anti-venoms for Central and South America. They produce anti-venoms, or they were producing for us, for Taipan in New Guinea. They're working on Russell's Viper for Sri Lanka, anti-venoms for Africa, where there is a drought when it comes to anti-venoms.
Hey, sorry about that.
Okay, where did you lose me?
We talk about the medical research building, the Taipans in it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I'll start with the New Guinea stuff again. Okay, let me know when you're recording.
Yeah, still recording.
So, I started working on snake bite in New Guinea, in Papua New Guinea, in 1990 with doctors from Oxford University's Department of Medicine and the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. And I was going out when they had a lot of bites from the area. I was going out and catching taipans and death adders and so forth, and milking them. And then at the turn of the century, Oxford sort of pulled out of the project to a degree, and it was taken over by the Australian Venom Research Unit at the University of Melbourne, AVRU. And they offered me a fellowship to keep working with them. So from 2006, I was working with them. And I'd go over to New Guinea for a period of time. And David Williams, who's a very long-term friend of mine, and some of the other guys, Owen Piver and Ben Band, who are both Papua New Guinean nationals, we'd go out and catch venomous snakes. We had one location, which I will not disclose, where Wolfgang Wooster was with us as well, and his wife, Kathy Pook. They were on honeymoon, and we were out catching snakes. And in one location...
Sounds like a really good honeymoon. Sounds like a really
well, they went diving because they've got to do the honeymoon-y stuff. But we were... Yeah, we weren't. We were out looking for snakes. We were out for taipan. And in 1 week, we saw 46 taipan, and caught 10 of them, because they're very fast. They are really fast. And so we had a unit, probably the safest building in the whole country, that nobody wanted to break into, on the campus of the Port Moresby General Hospital. And that's where we kept our venomous snakes. And they were looked after by a Papua New Guinean called Jasper, who was a right character. I mean, he chewed buai all the time, betel nut. He was always... When he was chewing buai, he was laughing like a crazy man. We'd go out catching snakes, and I'd be in boots. He was barefoot. I've been out and camped with him out on the Brown River, and he's wandered off in the morning barefoot and come back in the mid-morning with a taipan that he's caught wearing just a pair of shorts and carrying a snake hook. And like he was just magic around taipans. He did get bitten once, though. Survived that. But we would we'd milk the snakes and dry the venom. And we sent the taipan venom to the, in my opinion, the true heroes of snake bite research. Now, it's not the big biopharma companies. It's not the pathologists in the field. The big heroes is the Instituto Clodomiro Picado in the University of San Jose in Costa Rica. That's a university department, not a biopharma. And they are producing antivenoms. They produce antivenoms for Costa Rica, for all of Central and South America. They were producing antivenom for us for taipan from New Guinea. They were producing, don't know if they've done it yet, but they were going to produce Taipan for Russell's Viper in Sri Lanka, which is, it's the main killer there, kills a lot of people. They have produced anti-venoms for African venomous snakes, because the big companies that used to produce anti-venom for Africa, the German company Behringwerk and the French company Pasteur, basically pulled out of producing anti-venom for regular people. They, Pasteur produced some, but it was available for like French operatives working on mines and things like that. So there's actually a big drought for anti-venom in Africa. And ICP, Instituto Clodomiro Picado, were trying to fill that drought by producing antivenoms, and not just producing antivenoms, not making a massive profit out of it. For instance, Taipan antivenom from the Commonwealth Serum Laboratory in Australia, by the time it gets to New Guinea, just Taipan or polyvalent, right? You are talking for one vial, one ampule to treat one snake bite victim, you're talking $2,500 US. Now that's comparable with Crofab in the US. But
yeah.
But people in Papua New Guinea, their healthcare's free. The government has to pay for it. We have free healthcare. No matter what happens to us here, we don't have to pay for it. And so the government is buying this antivenom. And it's so expensive, they've got a glass ceiling how much they can spend on antivenom every year. And the trouble is that as the prices go up, that glass ceiling doesn't go up. If anything, it's coming down. And so they buy less, and they were able to buy less antivenom every year. And so very often the hospitals ran out of antivenom. And when they ran out of antivenom, you've got to artificially ventilate the patient using an ambu bag, you know, the black bag that you do by hand. So you've got to treat, yeah, you've got to teach the relatives of the victim that they have got to keep pumping this bag nonstop in relays for 3, 4, or even 5 days, because there aren't enough ventilators to put the people on ventilators. So it's down to hand ambu bagging. And I've known a situation where there were 10 people in the hospital with Taipan bites and 7 of them died. And that was in a fairly short time, and included a pregnant woman, because they hadn't got enough healthcare. So we were trying to improve on this by working with ICP in Costa Rica. And they produced an antivenom that was just as good as the CSL product. It kept as well, provided it wasn't allowed to get, you know, it was freeze dried, so it didn't have to be under 8 degrees, but it didn't want to be at room temperature. And it was $250. Right? So that's 10%. So they can have, yeah, ten times as much antivenom. They see the glass ceiling's out of sight. Fantastic. We got there. We're going to start working on a small-eyed snake for which there's no specific antivenom, but then the project got closed down. And I'm not going to go into the politics of that, but they're probably back to CSL now and people dying. And for me, ICP are the heroes. And if we were able to keep producing Papuan Taipan venom, dry venom, and shipping it to ICP, hopefully they could get the antivenom. But it went through its 3-year blind trial and everything. It was a marvel. And that's over. But that was the more recent work I've done on snake bite was with the University of Oxford and Adelaide. And I was in Myanmar in 2018, just before two things happened. One, COVID. And two, the generals kicked off again. Myanmar is not in a healthy place at the moment. Myanmar's not, and a lot of people are fleeing the country, and there's a lot of killing of tribal groups by the generals like the Chin and the Shan and so forth. And basically there's militia armies fighting the government. And you can't carry on. You could take Médecins Frontières in and Sans Frontières and they could look after injured people, but you can't be in there going catching venomous snakes and milking them and shipping the venom, because this isn't the time for that. But I got a number of Nyakahuthia, Dubuisimensis, Trimerosaurus albolabris, Trimerosaurus erythrorus, Bungarus fasciatus, and several Mandalayensis, the Burmese spinning cobra. And I was wearing glasses and protective goggles. And these fellas are spitting, and they're spitting, and it's hitting my forehead, and my sweat is taking it south. So I still got it in both eyes. It was a bit tricksy. And I've got some great pictures of my hotel room before I delivered all the snakes to the venom labs in Yangon. It was very funny. I've got all these venomous snakes in my hotel room in bags, hanging up in the shower and all sorts of things. So you don't walk around without putting the lights on at night. But I've got nowhere else to put all these highly venomous snakes. I've got pictures of the cobras swimming in the bath, and then when they'd had their bath, I gave the Russell's vipers a swim. But I've got all these in my room. And I've got a sign on the door that says, absolutely no room service. Do not come in. So the young hotel staff were very interested to know. And whenever they brought up room service or something, they're trying to peep around the door to see what I've got in the room that I won't let them in to see. And I'm trying to stop them seeing into the room. And they go away and they were curious. And the one day I went downstairs into the foyer of the hotel, and all the staff, all the young staff, they jumped up and they stood to attention. And I thought, oh shit, they've Googled me. They did know what I did. Somebody said, well, let's see if he's on Google. Well, yeah, I am, aren't I? And they found out who I was, and no question about wanting to do room service in my room. But they after that, they anything I wanted, no problem at all. They're all standing to attention, which was quite sweet, really, because they're all young. Yeah. But I got two containers of Trimerosaurus albolabris. I got eight in each box. And the one day I checked them, and there were only seven in the one box. So I thought, oh shit. So I spent the next 3 hours turning the hotel room upside down, checking everywhere. And where there was little gaps, I was butting my hand in, hoping it would bite me rather than some poor unsuspecting hotelier. I couldn't find it anywhere. Everything's up. My bags, everything's chaos. Search. I'm sure a lot of herpers have gone through this. This resonates, I'm pretty sure. And then I thought, I only checked them once. Maybe I should count again. So I counted again. Guess what? Eight. It hadn't got out at all. I just miscounted. I don't know that for nothing.
That story's giving me a few flashbacks. And not even to necessarily reptiles, just other things that happen in life. Always double check. Always count again before you decide to tear a room up. Okay, giving me flashbacks.
Sounds really poor at the moment.
To other moments in my life. Yeah, maybe not necessarily reptiles, but other stuff as well.
Oh yeah, I was taking some cobras from the safari park up to the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine once, and I got the trap boxes in the back, and I stopped off at home, which was part way, and I went around to get something out of the belt. At the back, and I noticed one of the trap boxes was slightly open, and I should have had, I don't know, 10 cobras of various species and that, and I thought, oh right, and I'd look inside and the box was empty. It definitely had come out. So I had everything out of the car on the lawn, everything, the boxes and everything. I had drapes that I would throw over the boxes to keep them dark and so forth. Everything's on the lawn. And I'm just about to get the socket set to take the seats out of my Land Rover Defender when I saw one of the drapes I dropped on the lawn lift up at the one end and out shot the Cobra. And I must have cleared that lawn and caught it so fast. And I had it back in the box before you could say Jack Robinson. Yeah. So always double check you've closed boxes with venomous snakes or any kind of animal, really.
Yeah.
I remember transporting an alligator across the country once from our collection to another one. And it was too big to go in a box. And I'm driving an estate car and it was loose in the back under a blanket. And it was about a 5-foot gator and its mouth was taped up and it was in the back and it all was fine. I'm driving and I've picked up an old friend of mine, the late John Foden. He was curator of reptile, well, curator of the whole zoo, the place called Drayton Manor, which is north of Birmingham, in the original Birmingham, the one in England. And he was a really old friend of mine. We'd known each other decades. He sadly passed away in 1999. And he'd got a crook finger where a rattlesnake had bitten him, a Western Diamondback, got the fang stuck in his knuckle and couldn't get him off. So that's what he did with a crook finger. But I've picked John up and he's coming over with me and he's sat next to me. I'm driving and I looked across and John is wearing an alligator-shaped Davy Crockett's hat. Basically, the alligator had come... I mean, it's an estate car. I forget what you call an estate car. Oh, bloody hell. It's two seats and everything else is flat in the back. Like a... my brother had done. Yeah, well, anyway, it doesn't really matter. This alligator had got its front legs on John's shoulders and its head on top of his head. And it's trying to climb over him to get into the front of the car. And it's a 5-foot gator. And John... he's holding it by the snout and he's trying to push it back and it's trying to push forward. And I said, John, what are you doing? He says, the alligator wants to come in the front. I said, John, there isn't room for us and an alligator in the front. He said, I know that. You know that. But the bloody alligator doesn't. He eventually managed to push it back. We had to stop and throw blankets over it again so he'd go back to sleep. That was funny.
Yeah, I've never had an alligator loose in my car. Well, I have transported a 6-foot-long saltwater crocodile from Chicago to Houston, and fortunately, they did have a container for it, so I just had to work with it climbing into the front seat with me.
Well, I have to say, saltwater crocodiles are in a totally different ball game. I mean, compared, alligators are—they're really pretty amenable. I remember being at the safari park and I was fixing a light and I was on the fence between the Nile crocodiles and the alligators, and I was balanced on this fence and I picked up a piece of wood that had fallen in the water and threw it backwards and in so doing dislocated my shoulder. So I'm now on a narrow fence. And I've got a dislocated shoulder, so I can't climb back. So I had to figure which way I was going to topple. And the alligators were twice the size of the Niles, but it was a no-brainer. I went in with the gators with a dislocated shoulder.
Yeah.
And came out that way because I remember, I mean, I was working with the Nile Crocs the one time in waders, cleaning the inside of the glass, and I'm wearing waders. And one of them hit me like a submarine under the water and bit the whole bottom of the wader off. So, but only put a couple of small holes in my leg, but I thought, right, okay, I'm having a cage when I'm working in here next time. And I had a cage made, 3-sided cage, that I could move along and stand inside and clean the glass, and they'd be bouncing off the outside of it underwater because they were quite stroppy. We called them Ronnie and Reggie, who were our famous gangsters, Ronnie and Reggie Cray. They were London gangsters in the 60s, and we called these two Nile Crocs Ronnie and Reggie. And the one day I lifted up the box, the metal, 3-sided metal thing, to move it along, put it down again, stepped, and found I was standing on one of them inside the box. I thought, no, how do I get out of this? So I sort of shuffled round, so I was facing the other way, pushed the box back. It was a mesh, a strong mesh, strong metal mesh. Pushed it back, ran up it, and jumped for the land, and landed there. Because they were really bad-tempered. They were pretty bad-tempered. Niles, so Salty is the same, you know, I mean. Yeah. Gators are pussycats.
Yeah. I've worked with quite a few of those in my past, so I could agree with you on the Salties versus Gators comparison. So.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. You know, I mean, I've seen some big Salties in New Guinea. When we used to drive out of Port Moresby, all the rivers there, the Goldie, the Lalokie, the Brown River, the Vanapa, the Veimari, they're all soup brown rivers, and they're big, deep rivers running to a place called Galley Reach, where the saltwater crocodiles breed, and they're all crocodile rivers. And if you go at night, you can sometimes see the eyes off these big bridges. These are big metal bridges put in by the army.
Yeah.
And if you stop on one of these bridges, all the village kids will come running out. You get all these young boys of 12, 14 or whatever. They'll come running out. And if they see you've got a camera, they want you to take their pictures while they jump off the bridge into the Croc River. And we go, no, don't, too late, gone. And there'll be another one, done. I don't know if any of them didn't come up, but they had absolutely no fear. But they're jumping. And it's a long way down to the water. And when they jump there, there's a potential. There's a croc waiting for them. And it's just, you just think, this is absolutely ridiculous. Stop doing that.
Yeah. They
just, take my photo. Hey, mister, take my photo.
Yeah, especially with how smart crocs are at recognizing prey behavior. Might only take one croc one time to realize whatever a car stopped on the bridge, they might have a free delivery meal fly out of the sky.
Yeah, it won't take them long to work it out. And I'm sure people do get taken in New Guinea. And people get taken in Timor. In Timor, one of our field assistants was taken in Lake Ilalalaro. It's practically landlocked lake at the far eastern end of East Timor, Timor Leste, and it has a population
I think I know what lake you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the only lake. There's a couple of petrified lakes with loads of dead trees with nothing in, but it's the lake, and it's a seasonal lake. It shells and swells and shrinks, but There's a turtle in the lake, a snake neck turtle, the Timor snake neck turtle. It's the only place it's found, and I've only got photos of one. We're obviously quite concerned that people would come and try and collect them, but that's a problem for people coming to get them, because there are 350 saltwater crocodiles in the lake, and all the people that live in the village around the villages around the lake, they are fishermen. And I've got photos of them going fishing. They are standing up to their waist with throw nets or fishing rods, fishing for fish. And I've seen the crocs in there. I watched a croc following a water buffalo and a calf, hoping to get the calf. They're big crocs. And the people are standing in the water. And the reason they're standing in the water is that there is a story that if boats are put on the lake, all the fish will die. Now, that might be true because people could then outfish it. But basically, boats are forbidden. So if you want to go fishing there and you don't want to stand on the bank, you've got to go in the water. And so this would mean that anyone wanting to collect turtles is going to have to do it walking around in a lake full of saltwater crocodiles. So, and also the locals are aware that people would come for the turtles and are quite wary of that. Fortunately, there's been quite a lot of homegrown conservation. But we were working there. Hinrich Kaiser from Victor Valley College in California and myself and our students worked in Timor on 10 phases between 2009 and 2014. And we went to Lake Illaro several times. And the one time we went, the guy who'd been our guide in the forest had been taken by a saltwater crocodile only a few months earlier. And, you know, people do get taken. The final time I was there, I saw something very unusual. There was a papyrus raft on the lake. Not a very substantial thing, just a papyrus raft made out of lightweight wood bound together and stuff like that. And they were fishing from it. And so obviously somebody had said, is a raft a boat? And somebody else had obviously said, no, a raft is not a boat. Therefore, we can use a raft on the lake so we don't get eaten by crocodiles. Well, you're still only about 3 inches off the water. So I don't know what protection that gives in the most flimsy craft you've ever seen. But I suppose it's something. And I thought about this and I thought, well, this, I'm a Catholic, or supposed to be a Catholic, and Catholics can't eat meat on Fridays. So they eat fish, which is not meat. Yeah, tell that to a vegetarian. Fish is meat, but it's one of these things that's been conjured up to get a loophole. And so now you can go out on a papyrus raft on Lake Illalaro, but I still wouldn't bank on not getting eaten by a salty.
Yeah, I wouldn't fish on a raft or in the water. I probably wouldn't even be on the too close to the bank even.
No, I've seen them in New Guinea. I knew there was one under the water this one time, and it was a big croc, and I got a bit of timber, and I just threw it into the water just away from the bank, and it erupted in a maelstrom. Jaws, and then he was up to the bank, and he's there partially coming up the bank, and I wanted to get photos of it. It was a big croc. I didn't measure it, but it was a big salty, and I wanted to get photos, but I didn't want to stand directly in front of him because I'm sure he was just waiting for me to get directly in line, and then he'd kick off and he'd be on top of me. So I was standing just to the side, leaning over, trying to get the photos. And I got decent photographs without risking my life. Yeah. But I don't do much with crocs.
Yeah. I was about to ask with your experience with Nova Guinea and Hala, if they're...
I've seen smaller freshwater crocs, and I obviously don't know at this point in time whether Nova Guinea or Hali. But I've seen quite a lot of crocs around the world in my time.
So
gators and caiman, of course. Go on.
Speaking of around the world, what's been your favorite place to go exploring and field work in, and what's one
Papua
place
New Guinea. It is, because it used to market itself as the land of the unexpected, and it most assuredly is that. It's also one of the most dangerous places I've worked, and I suppose that adds a certain something to it. It's harder to do field work, but I'm just completely fast. Anyone who's been to Papua New Guinea and done work there will tell you it gets into their blood. It's I mean, I've worked in a lot of wonderful countries. I've worked I worked in Brazil for a good while. I've worked in more South American countries than I haven't. I've worked in 7 or 8 African countries, a lot of Asian countries, some great places, but I'm still drawn back to New Guinea. It's just draws me in.
Yeah. And what's one place in the world that you haven't gone herping in that you would like to someday?
Top of my bucket list.
Yeah.
Socotra.
I can see that.
Socotra? Socotra? Okay, I'll tell you where it is. First off, it's an island. It's Yemeni.
Oh, the one Yemen in the Red Sea, right?
Yeah, halfway to...
Not the Red Sea, the Somalia. Indian Ocean.
Yeah, Persian Gulf. Halfway to Somalia, yeah. But it's, I mean, snakes, it's got some endemic thread snakes, Leptotiflops. It doesn't, it's, there is stories of a large cobra from there. They've not been proven. But the skinks and the geckos alone, I mean, there are 10 species of Hemidactylus, 7 of which are endemic. It's fascinating. The trees look like they've been pulled up and turned upside down and replanted with the roots in the air. And my good friend Yanis Els has been there with the United Arab Emirates troops, because I think Saudi Arabia and the UAE were worried that Iran, who was supporting the Houthis, might annex Socotra. And so I think the UAE sent troops in to annex it first. But oddly enough, also on my bucket list is Iran. I'd love to go to Iran. I've been invited to go to Iran to work with Iranian herpetologists. But my university head of school said, Mark, we're not paying the ransom. And it's UK policy never to pay ransoms. That is, you know, UK does not pay ransoms ever. And so, you know, until things have changed and it's safer, I can't go to Iran. But Iran has a totally fascinating and very, very diverse herpetofauna. Yeah. And I the closest I've been to it was the Musandan Peninsula, which is a piece of Oman that points at Iran. If you look at a map, you can see it pointing up from Oman. And I went up there with my friend Johannes, and it's like a Marscape up there. And you're looking across the Straits of Hormuz? Anyway, you're looking towards Iran. Yeah, that's somewhere I'd like to go one day. And there are other places, but yeah, I've been to, I suppose, about 50 countries if I added them all up.
Have you ever done any field herping or work in the United States at all?
I've spent a lot of time in the US. I've been to quite a lot of states. I've been out herping with American herpers. That's great fun. You know, I was guesting with Kansas Herp Sock many years ago and went out with them. I've been out with herpers, and of course I made a number of films in Big Adventure in the US in 1999. Excuse me. But I've not done any what I'd call work, any original work. I'm just interested in finding and photographing and, you know, seeing the species. And most times when I come to the United States, like I'm going to be in the States, I'll be at the SSAR in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, but only on the Friday. Pardon?
That'd be like 2.5-3 hours away from me then.
Be sorry, say it again.
So you'll be like 2.5 to 3 hours away from where I live then.
Oh, I see. Well, I've been a member of the SSAR for 45 years, and I've never been to a meeting because I was a member because I got the journals since 1980. And I'm actually going to be working in the Museum of Zoology at the University of Michigan on Papuan snakes. I either visit museums or I have loans sent to me. I had a loan of 13 snakes sent over from Yale University. I just put them back into ethanol yesterday. I've got specimens from Harvard, specimens from Honolulu, from the Bishop Museum, specimens from the Australian Museum, specimens from the museum in Paris, and I work on in my lab. In fact, I've got 4 new species of snakes sitting here in my lock cupboard. But I'm going to be coming over to Michigan to look at their reasonably large collection of Papuan snakes and document and photograph them, scale count them, etc., measure them, etc. And as it happens, the SSAR is taking place in the latter part of that week. And it starts, I think, on the Wednesday or the Thursday and continues to the Sunday. Well, I'm going to drop into the SSAR for one day on the Friday. I can't do any more because I'll be flying back out on the Saturday. So I'll be back in the UK by the Sunday. But it'd be nice to pop in because I'll see people I haven't seen for a long time, you know? Yeah. And I mean, Craig Adler's, well, I was in touch with Craig Adler and he said, oh, you really should come. There'd be lots of your old friends there. And I said, well, I'd like to. I must get in touch with him and tell him, well, actually, Craig, I am going to be there, but only for one day. It's all I can fit in because I've got to work through all the museum specimens because that was my main reason for coming across to Michigan. And I need to come over and spend some time in the American Museum of Natural History again, which is a great collection. I was over there, God, it must be 10 or 12 years ago. I need to come back. But when I come to the States, it's often to work in the museums. And I don't get as much chance to go out and photograph herps. I know everyone's going to go, oh, I'll come and take you out. Great, great. I'd love that. But my priority is working on the dead snakes. That's what I've got to do. And much though it is great fun to go and see copperheads and things like that, I've got a university grant to come and do this research. I can't get sidetracked and go off and do fun things looking for live snakes because I'm supposed to be an academic.
Speaking of New World snakes, I can't remember was it the Aruba rattlesnake was the one you bred?
Yeah, first UK captive breeding at the Safari Park. We beat London Zoo and Chester Zoo to the draw with that. Yeah, that's a long time ago. And first UK breeding of Taylor's Canteel as well. Taylori. That is a long time behind, as they say in Papua New Guinea. Yeah.
Okay.
I've not been to Aruba. I would like to go to Aruba, but there's so many other places I've got to go before I go. You know, there's so many places I'd like to go. And, you know, Rick Shine's new book, his autobiography. Was it So Many Snakes, So Little Time? Yeah, I can concur with that.
Yeah,
you should read it. It's very good.
Yeah, probably go on Amazon after this and look it up. See if
Rick Shine and Harry Green are probably the two leading lights. So there's lots more people doing snake ecology, but they've been doing it for so long that they are probably the two gods of snake ecology. And Harry's a lovely bloke to spend time with in the field. He came over and went adder hunting over here. You know, Harry Green, he wrote Snake's Mystery. I can't remember the full title, but it's got some really nice sort of thoughtful essays in it. His book. And he's working on another book at the moment, I think. Yeah.
Okay. What was it like making O'Shea's Adventures?
Surreal, I think. Surreal, because I didn't expect to get to be in that position because I didn't set out to be in that position. It sort of happened. And it was great fun. I went to places I couldn't ordinarily have gone, either because of expense or because of restrictions like Ashmore and Hibernia Reefs, which are 30 hours by boat out of Broome in Western Australia. You know, it's a protected area. You know, it's amazing. It was phenomenal. And I loved all the films. And people have said to me, oh, would you ever do anything like that again? And I've said, yes, I would, but not at the same pace. But I did discuss with some of my old directors who directed then, are now mostly executive producers now, and we were chatting about the idea of doing O'Shea's Revisited. So 20 to 25 years on, going back to some of the stories and seeing what's changed, and maybe telling some of the new stories that didn't exist back then, because O'Shea's Big Adventure is a quarter of a century old. 1999 to 2003, so it's between 20 and 25 years or thereabouts. So yeah, a lot's happened. I've got older for a start, and all my hair's gone white.
Yeah, like you just said, so much, so little time, so many snakes.
Exactly. But that's not my quote. That's Rick Shines. You've got to give him that. That's a great title.
Yeah. Currently blanking on questions. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Out of my snake bite research, my snake bite research got recognized here in Britain when it was very odd. During COVID, I had an email arrive, didn't recognize the address. It had a PDF attached, and it said, "Please open this PDF urgently." And I thought, yeah, this is phishing, or it's a virus. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. So I nearly threw it in the trash, but something stopped me. And the next day, I saw it there, and I thought, I wonder what that is. I wonder if there's a way of previewing a PDF, just seeing the first page, in the same way you can preview photographs to see what the image is without opening it. So I did a little bit of looking around on the internet, and apparently there is. So I did it, and it opened the bloody PDF. And I thought, oh no, infection.
Yeah.
But nothing happened. And there was this really strange thing, and it, at the top it said, Professor Mark O'Shea, MBE. And I'll explain that bit in a minute. And I'm looking down, and I'm looking for the bit where they asked for my credit card details, and it didn't happen. It went several pages down. And it all looked like it had come from an official department in London. It said the Chancery Office. And there were a couple of phone numbers. So I phoned one of them, and I got an answer machine. So I thought, that's not good. And so I looked at the numbers, and I looked up the Chancery Office in London, and it's a big building, and the phone numbers fell within the series that were for the Chancery Office. So I thought, this might actually be genuine. So I phoned the other number, and this woman answered, and I said, I've had a PDF from you by email. She said, oh, yes, who are you? And I said, I'm Mark O'Shea. She said, yes. I said, is this a scam? She said, no, it's genuine. Please read it and respond. And so I did. And I was being asked if I would accept an MBE in the Queen's birthday honours list. Now, that means nothing in the States, but it's a big deal over here. You have an MBE is a member of the most meritorious order of the British Empire. And above that is an OBE, which is an officer of the most meritorious order of the British Empire. And above that is a CBE, which is a commander of the most meritorious order of the British Empire. And above that are two levels of knighthood, where they call you sir. So I'm thinking, this is a bit mega. And I was being asked if I would accept it. And it was for higher education, reptile conservation, something else, and snake bite research. And it said, do not tell anybody. Just respond and say you'll do it. And normally, Well, I did ask the woman when I spoke to her, why did you send it an email, not a letter? And she said COVID. So I got an email. And normally you're not allowed to mention it. If you tell people you've got it, you've been offered this and you're going to receive this, it can be withdrawn. You're not allowed to mention it until it has gone out to the media and is public knowledge. And then you can talk about it. And that normally is about a month down the line. Now, this was May, and normally in June or July, it'd be public. But it wasn't made public till October, by which time I'd forgotten about it because we got COVID. And I didn't go down to receive it until November 2021, 18 months after it had been awarded. And I received, it would have been the Queen, but she was poorly. And I received my MBE from Princess Anne, the Princess Royal. And it was all proper morning suit and the whole thing. It was at Windsor Castle, and all the troops were in ceremonial. And as I went up the stairs, they all clashed their sabers on their breastplates. It was absolutely phenomenal, once-in-a-lifetime experience. It was just incredible. And I stepped forward onto the red carpet, and she pinned my medal on my morning coat. And she started talking to me, and she was asking me about snake bite, because she'd been in Zambia some years earlier and she'd seen snake bites. And she's doing her arm into a vertical position, and she's showing skin hanging, you know, skin hanging off the arm. And she said, what would cause that? And I'm saying, puff adder or a spitting cobra. And she said, there are cobras in Africa. I thought they're Asian. I said, well, actually, there's more species of cobra in Africa than there are in Asia. But they're in both. And I'm talking to her about it. She's absolutely fascinated. Very, very knowledgeable. Very, very personable lady. And then she steps back, and that's your cue to back off. Don't turn your back on her. Back off. And then you go out. And that's you're done. And people are saying to me afterwards that other people who've been there, they go, what's she doing? I said, oh, she's just asking me what could have caused snake bites and caused your skin to hang off your arm. So yeah, that was one of the best moments of my life. Because I'm a huge monarchist. I think that the British royal family, for all the things that have happened to them, they are still extremely important. Britain was only a republic briefly, and that was when you got it, when he executed the first Charles, and now we've got the third Charles.
Let's see, we're probably sitting about an hour and a half right now.
I'm just thinking if there's anything else to drop in to tell you. I mean, so much is happening. So many projects. One of my it looks like I'll be going to China at the end of the year. I'm going to the World Congress in Borneo in August, but it looks like might be going to China at the end of the year. The Chengdu Institute of Biology invited me over because my book of snakes, the first edition, has been translated into Chinese, and the people who reviewed it and translated it are top herpetologists at Chengdu Institute of Biology, and they've invited me over because they want to meet me and they want to talk to me about potential collaborations on natricid snakes and things like that. So it's always nice to have something that's coming up that's new. I've never been to China, so that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, most welcome. I enjoy having a chat like this. It's great fun. And someday I'll have to put all my stories in a book. It's just, there's always other books I've got to write first. You know, I've got to finish The Snakes of New Guinea, which is going to be a big book. And it looks like Bob Ashley down at Chiricahua Desert Museum, Eco, he's probably going to publish it because we've talked about this. So, but I enjoy doing podcasts and chatting to people and sharing the knowledge and just basically telling war stories.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for the invitation, Nate.